American Social History Podcasts are a production of the American Social History Project Center for Media and Learning at the City University of New York Graduate Center. Visit us online at ashp.cuny.edu. In part one of this podcast, Gregory Downs of City College of New York, CUNY, speaks to New York City teachers about the origins of slavery in the early American colonies and its subsequent expansion. This talk took place on December 4th, 2008, at the Graduate Center.
I appreciate you all having me here and getting the opportunity to talk to you about slavery and about some of the things that that scholars are working on as they think through what slavery is and about some of the ways that this might be useful to you or interesting to you as you think about the ways that you teach in your classrooms. But the first thing that I want to say is that assessing slavery, talking about slavery, describing slavery is, as people who wrote about it from the 1830s on, an impossible process. So that we're here to do something that is almost literally impossible. And this was something that you see repeated over and over again if you read the words that people, famous writers who toured, like Frederick Douglass, writers who wrote long after slavery about their memories of it, of which there were thousands of volumes, many of which are barely known but are easily accessible, that they would say it was almost impossible to sum up what slavery was. They would say there were aspects of slavery, some of which we'll talk about today, that people could relate to, but the fact that they could relate to it posed their own problems. Because on the one hand, slavery included these things that were relatable. Lots of, you know, hard work and toil, which was not unusual in the 19th century. People digging ditches on the Erie Canal died in that construction. The hard physical labor was something that many people could relate to. Breakup of families. Physical violence, whipping, rapes, that slavery included these things that people, readers, could relate to. But then, as they wrote about these things, writers would pull back and say, even if you think you can understand what slavery is, at some level you can't, because it included not just those things, but also this condition that they said that no free person could fully understand, which was the condition of being not free, of being property. And even as they wrote this, other writers who had been slaves would say not only could free people not understand what slavery was, that it was impossible to sum it up for people who had never been slaves, but even other slaves couldn't really understand what slavery was. Harriet Jacobs famously wrote that male slaves, that the slavery for men was not the same as slavery for women, and that even male slaves who heard her could not understand the particular ways that being a female slave structured her experience. And so from the beginning, we approach this with a kind of humility, that there's an impossibility of recovering exactly what it meant to be a slave. And there's also a slipperiness, an ease with which slavery can be not an actual condition of people who were property in a forced labor system that broke up their families, that, you know, involved physical beatings, that involved rape, that involved all these other things. There's an ease with which this can be lost as a metaphor. And throughout the 19th century and even now, you see people compare things to slavery that involve some aspect of what slavery was, but that don't involve this totality. And so part of what I want to start with is that sense of humility, that describing slavery becomes an impossible task, both because it was this wide, huge system and because it involved this fundamental difference of what it meant to be property, an almost unimaginable thing. As former slaves toured the United States, toured England trying to describe it, it's posed a problem for more than 150 years. How do we define what slavery was? Recently, this problem has gotten more and more complex because as we look back to see what slavery was, we find also that its size, its duration, its vastness, the fact that it changed and took so many different forms also makes it difficult for us to really sum up what slavery was. That when you think about slavery, most Americans have an image of, you know, that's set by popular culture of sort of a cotton plantation of vast hundreds of slaves, of slave owners, you know, up in their, you know, second floor study, occasionally looking out. And it turns out that this is, A, describes only one small moment in American slavery, and B, even then describes an unusual condition. That slavery was something that was always changing, that was always in the midst of being changed by economic forces, political forces, social forces.
And that when we think about the scale and the size of it, helps us understand why it's so hard to sum up. By 1860, there were more than 4 million slaves in the United States. Well, you see that from the beginning, summing up an institution that affected 4 million people, almost impossible. And then when we think about what some of those slaves did, you go from everything, from people who are slaves to individual families in high mountains, you know, working alongside them in the fields, working alongside their owners in the fields, to people who are working on this sort of more common image of the cotton plantation, to people working in actual factories in places like Richmond, Virginia, where factories set up upon northern models of heavy industry, but staffed by slavery, this experiment in industrial slavery, to smith shops, and working in jobs as wide-ranging as sugar pressers, sailors. Although it seems counterintuitive to us, sailing was actually in many ways coded a slave profession, and that much of the waterways of the South were operated by slaves, as in fact a good deal earlier of the harbor in New York City had been operated by slaves. Carriage drivers, foremen, that it challenges our ability to summarize and to say this is what a slave is, this is what slavery is, because it was many things at once. It was at once this condition of not being free, and then it was also 1,000 or even 10,000 different ways of experiencing that condition of unfreedom. But despite this impossibility, for more than 150 years, first former slaves and white travelers and abolitionists, and then scholars have been trying this impossible project, trying to explain what ex-slave Peter Randolph wrote was the key problem, what American slavery is. And what slavery was, trying to explain that as a way to awaken people in the North to the problem of slavery, to awaken slaveholders in the South to the sin of slavery, and to awaken, as most famously Frederick Douglass, but also dozens and then eventually even hundreds of other lecturers did, a nation to the problem of slavery, of what slavery was. At the same time, as they tried to portray it, this has always done multiple work. That it's always been aimed at the same time to show what it was, what the condition was of life of slavery, and also to articulate how it was possible to live as a human being within slavery, what kind of system slavery was, what the goals of slave owners were, how this system could seem to control your life, and yet also at the same time, how it is that slaves found ways to carve out their own individual moments of autonomy. And even more so, what I'm going to talk about today, which is how they were able to find moments where they could carve out social spaces, where they could build some notion of finding a human element in slavery through the construction of some forms of communities. So that at the same time, we have to be conscious as we look at slavery of both things, the power that slavery had, a legal power, a physical power, a military power, and also the capacity, the fact that it never had complete power over individual slaves, that there were these moments of capacity for individual resistance and for some kind of social resistance. Now, before we jump in, so in this talk, what I'm going to do is to give you quickly a sort of outline of how slavery came to be, some sort of basic, you know, facts about what different stages of American slavery. And then in the heart of the talk, talk to you about how within that world, American slaves worked to build communities, not a single community, not something that sprung up from out of the ground or that sprung out of a shell, but build and made communities, associations through things like religion and family that you talked about, through political networks, through communities of shared experience that they could use to try to redefine or partly redefine slavery upon their own terms. And the ways that their efforts to do that changed slavery, not just for them, but also created sets of problems that would change slavery for their masters. But first, let's take a step back and sort of just quickly talk a little bit about what slavery is. That while we're going to focus here upon the development of what slavery was in the United States, which is mostly 17th, 18th, 19th century system of large-scale agricultural labor, that slavery had a long history. In fact, a history that seems to be longer than history itself, to date back before we have written records. That across the world, in almost every society, had practiced some form or another of slavery, usually to resolve a central question, which is that in a war, what did you do with prisoners? One answer was to kill them. But this posed not only, you know, perhaps ethical problems, but more to the point, practical problems. That it didn't do you that much good to kill prisoners in the long run. And so were there other ways of incorporating them into your society that recognized them as dishonored, as weak, as not equal, but also allowed you to use them in some way. And slavery emerged around the world as a way of one way of resolving this problem, of the seeming social death of a slave, that instead of actually dying, they would die as a free-functioning, autonomous individual person and be remade into a slave. Now, this could take all kinds of forms, forms that seem peculiar or bizarre to us and to Americans versed in an American form of slavery. But among the people who had been slaves throughout human history include people like Abram Hannibal, who became the highest-ranking general in Imperial Russia under Peter the Great, the Greek poet Aesop, many saints, more than one pope, Ibrahim Pasha, who was the Grand Vizier of the Ottoman Empire, John Smith, who founded the English colony at Jamestown, Virginia, Miguel de Cervantes, author of Don Quixote, as well as many, many others, people who were slaves and yet did not experience slavery in the way that we see it in the American context as part of an agricultural life at a plantation. And in fact, the Ottoman Empire particularly valued slaves as leading counselors because the belief was that if you appointed someone from a leading family to be your grand minister, well, they might try and muscle you out. And that a slave had particular benefits as the lead minister of the Ottoman Empire because they could not, in the end, be a challenge to the Sultan's authority. So slavery of taken is something that can be malleable, that's plastic, that can be used in many different ways. And the form that it took in the United States was not the only form that it could. But starting in the 15th, 16th century, starting really the 16th and 17th century, and flourishing in the United States in the 1700s and 1800s, we get a particular kind of slavery in the Western Hemisphere, in North and South America, one that is heavily dependent upon agriculture and mining, large-scale that exists for labor exploitation, and that involves this transportation of approximately 11 million Africans from Africa into some part of the north and south of the Western Hemisphere. And that became a profitable enterprise for British, French, Spanish, Portuguese, eventually after independence, the United States, through involvement in these crops that would be incredible moneymakers: sugar, tobacco, cotton, coffee, indigo, rice, along with, in some places, mining, and in some places with experimentations in industry and in factories. Now, this hemispheric slavery came to the United States in a couple of different ways. And one of the ways was just as part of this hemispheric system. The slavery came to South Carolina, which would be one of the centers of American slavery, in large part just as an easy transportation from Barbados. Barbados, at the time, was the most valuable real estate in the world in this era of sugar plantations. And so they're producing this incredible amount of sugar that's making this incredible amount of money for the British Crown, and they're not able to feed the slaves there. South Carolina develops as a rice plantation in large part to feed Barbados. And so we see slavery moving easily from the Caribbean into what would become the United States in that matter. But there's another place where slavery entered in that in many ways people take as more representative of how slavery entered the United States and the kind of problems that it posed, and that was Virginia. And of course, Virginia matters in the United States for all kinds of reasons, but not the least of which is that many of the leading figures in the American Revolution, these apostles of freedom, came from this plantation belt, were slave owners, tobacco plantation owners in Virginia: Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe. And that this one major river tributary produced these people who would not only be leaders in the revolution and in the nation, were also part of this extraordinarily powerful slave society. Now, how does slavery come to Virginia? And there we get a moment where we see different possibilities arise, that the slavery that exists in the United States becomes not the only slavery that was possible. In the early days, unlike South Carolina, Virginia was settled largely by whites. It was quickly determined that tobacco would be the profitable crop for Virginia. But the English settlers looked for white labor as the people who would actually work the tobacco plantations. Now, how did they get it? They brought in apprentices. So they would pay if someone showed up in the harbors or in a city in England, they said, "You want to go over to Virginia? If you work 4 to 7 years, we'll pay for your transportation. And at the end of this time, we'll work you for 4 to 7 years. You'll be this apprentice, not quite free, but not fully a slave, not for life. And at the end of it, we'll give you 100 acres and we'll give you some cash money and you'll go on your way." There were also people who wanted to set up Virginia upon slave labor, but by enslaving natives. But this became a practical impossibility because they knew the land better than the Virginians did, and they just slipped away. So, for the first decades, Virginia tobacco plantations ran largely with English labor. Now, why was this? Part of the reason was that slaves were expensive. It cost twice as much to buy a slave as to have an apprentice come over, as to have this forced English labor come over. And there was another part of the economic equation, which is that people died. Now here we're sort of talking, you know, the sort of extremely, you know, the sort of idea that life, you know, in a sort of pre-modern age, nasty, brutish, and short. You know, this was hardly true in Virginia. Roughly at least 4 to 7 years that one would work before getting the land grant or the money paid off. At one point, some of the averages are that maybe 8 to 10% of these people who came over from England lived that long. So practically, it made no sense to pay more for a slave, to own them for life, if both slaves and white Englishmen were going to be dead within 4 to 7 years anyway. If 90% of the people you bring over are going to be dead, then of course you get the cheapest people and you don't worry about whether you own them in perpetuity. And so this functioned, although there were some Africans brought into Virginia as early as 1619. The other interesting thing is that it seems it's very difficult to reconstruct. There are huge things that we don't know. There are years where we don't even know who was governor of Virginia, really basic things. So to claim that we know everything about the lives of these people working on the plantations would be a falsehood, would be a lie. But it seems that of these early shipments of Africans brought to Virginia, that many of them essentially were not treated as distinct from the white Englishmen. That many of them were apprentices, that they could, you know, work their time off. They were indentured servants rather than lifetime slaves. They intermarried, and they lived alongside these white English indentured servants without that much comment. Now, we know, and there were people who believed this is the way it's always going to be in Virginia. There may be some Africans around. Some of them may be slaves. Some of them may be indentured servants who find their own, who, you know, gain their own freedom after 4 to 7 years. And Virginia is going to become wealthy off of tobacco. Well, the last part happens. Virginia does become wealthy off of tobacco. By 1700, exporting 35 million pounds of tobacco a year to Europe. So you can imagine that's a lot of cigarettes, a lot of snuff that's being dipped, and producing an incredible amount of money. The King of England at one point was making 400,000 pounds a year off of taxes from Virginia alone. And that's in $1,700. So that actually is real money. Even by Wall Street terms, that's real money. At one point, Virginia alone was something like 40% of the king's wealth. That if you're a king and you're trying to figure out how do I make it through without having to get Parliament, you know, the British version of Congress, to pass more money for you, which of course they don't want to do. Well, this became this incredible bonanza. So that part of it turned out, it was an area that became incredibly wealthy out of tobacco. But the idea that this tobacco would be farmed, largely or partly, by white laborers, slipped away. Why did it? Well, there's two things that seem likely as explanations. Again, there's things that we don't know, but that would have significant impact for the way slavery would develop in the United States. And one was that the demographics changed. I told you before 90% of these indentured servants were dying in 4 to 7 years. Around 1650 to 1660, that stops. Our ability to understand medicine and disease in the 1650s is extremely limited. But it seems that people built up resistance to malaria, the other forms of fevers. It also seems that there were some incredibly crude and basic efforts at hygiene, disposing of waste, and that this made a big difference. People started living longer. Now, this seems good, right? We're for living longer. But this posed a real problem to these tobacco planters, because now, instead of 90% of their workers dying within 4 to 7 years, they're living. And at the end of it, they've got to give them 100 acres and pay them, so it's costing them money. And the economics of buy a slave or bring over an indentured servant starts to flip. At the same time, giving them 100 acres is not only expensive, but it poses a real problem, which is that tobacco, while we can easily sort of fall into these narratives that assume that the English, as they settled, defeated the natives quickly and established power, in fact, it was much more tenuous. And many tobacco planters had made treaties and deals with native tribes, where they said, leave us alone in our tobacco plantations on the river, and we'll keep these unruly people. these English workers, these African slaves and African servants, from coming up into the woods where you live. Well, eventually they ran out of land. And so, as these white workers said, I want my 100 acres and I want it up there, that it posed a problem for these planters who wanted to say, look, we've got a deal. They're not attacking us, and we're not, you know, infringing upon them. But where's the land going to come from? At the same time that these sort of basic economic and political challenges were happening, something else happened that very related to this, which is in 1676, so 100 years before the Revolution, Virginia had its own little civil war called Bacon's Rebellion. And this Bacon's Rebellion posed a lot of questions to slave owners who thought that to plantation owners who thought they had a workable system here. Because what happened there is one of these wealthy plantation owners, one of these sort of persons of this upper class from a high British family, comes over, finds himself Nathaniel Bacon, frustrated that he can't exert power in the colony, starts asking around, you know, figuring out what are the discontents. And the primary discontent that he finds is these white former apprentices, white former servants who want that land up in the woods, the land that the planters have said belongs to the natives. And so he organizes this as a political platform against the protected and nourished Indians. I mean, so this idea that he's trying to organize these agricultural laborers against the planters on the ground that the planters have cut a deal with the natives. He quickly realizes that he can not only enlist the help of these indentured servants, but also of slaves, of Africans, some of whom at this point are slaves, some of whom are still in this in-between category, and launches an attack upon the governor. After a series of battles, he loses, and at the end you get a final group of 100 of his supporters who are left, who refuse to surrender when others do. And of those supporters, 80 of them are Africans. So clearly he gained some support and was able to bridge some of these gaps that we might presume had existed between white English indentured servants and Africans who are some mix of slaves and servants. Well, this scared the you-know-what out of the planters. They looked around and said, this is not good, because there's not that many, you know, the whole point of being a planter was to own this huge plantation, which meant there weren't that many planters, and there were an increasingly large number of people out there who could be a threat to them. And so among the ways that they looked to resolve this problem was to cut back on what they saw as the most troublesome people, which is these servants from England. But they come over, they want land, they start trouble, and that's not worth it. And so on the one hand, you see this cutoff of English servants brought over to work on the tobacco plantations. On the other end, an increase, dramatic increase, in the number of Africans brought into Virginia to work on these tobacco plantations. And at the same time, they say the other thing that posed a problem here was that we had two different classes underneath us who were able to ally. That we had these white English farm workers and these Africans, and they got together, and that's what really caused instability. So they figure out, how do we divide them? And this is where you see the real start in Virginia of these laws that really separate out to say that Africans are treated one way and whites, even the poor whites, are treated a different way. Some of these things seem to us to be sort of hard to picture. One of the rights or privileges of being a white English worker in Virginia after Bacon's Rebellion was that if you were whipped, they had to keep your clothes on. Now, that didn't mean you couldn't be whipped, right? It's important to keep in context how this operates. But then Africans were routinely whipped by being stripped naked, which not only meant that it was more painful, but also meant that it was humiliating, right? It was a way of showing who was lower in class. The laws against intermarriage, it's easy to look back and to assume that if there were laws against intermarriage in the 1800s and the 1900s, that they must have been in place before then. And yet, it turns out that intermarriage was not that unusual in the 1600s in Virginia and Maryland. So these laws to say they can't marry. And then a practice at which, what did that actually mean? That while there were laws against fornication of many different types, in practical terms, what it meant was that white men were never prosecuted for having sex with women, with African women. But African men were prosecuted for having sex with white women. And so this buildup of this sort of American association that not only was slavery an agricultural system, but it was an agricultural system that was going to be based upon race, and that was also going to be based upon this division, this effort to create a division between African slaves and the poor whites in the area. And this would have enormous consequences for the development, not only of slavery, but also of the development of the country. Because this region, this compromise around the tobacco plantations, produces, as I said, these people who would be at the heart of what some call this American paradox of slavery and freedom, of champions of freedom, Washington, Jefferson, Madison, Monroe, who were also practitioners of slavery and arose out of the slave system. And so out of this profit and out of this paranoia, we get the development of American slavery and in many ways the development of an American nation. And that while it would take different forms in different parts of the country over different times, its basic parameter was set. And what is it that this slavery produced? Well, if you look at your handout, that you get a sense of some of the basics of it. That it produced a slave society in the United States that was different than most other places. That, for one thing, it produced a slave society in which people reproduced. It's easy to take this for granted. What else are they going to do? This seems like, you know, sort of common, you know, people have children. This, you know, has been going on literally since the dawn of time, or else there would be no dawn of time, right? And yet, strikingly, when you look at other slave societies in North and South America, that owners brought in, mostly men, worked them to quick deaths, and when they died, brought in more men. And so you get slave societies that are overwhelmingly male, and in which there's this constant diminishment of the slave population. The United States has experiences it differently. That in the United States, a slave population of about 700,000 in 1800 grows over 4 million by 1860. Even though, starting in 1808, the federal government bans the importation of new slaves. So the population increases almost six times in 70 years in which some slaves are still snuck in or get in through Louisiana or other places, but in which largely it comes through, quote unquote, natural reproduction. And this makes for a different world of slavery in the United States than almost anywhere else. That by the time of the Civil War, the vast majority of slaves had been born in the United States, had been from the day of birth speaking English, and in religious practices, we'll talk about, had been incorporated into American religious practices to some degree in ways that were highly unusual in the rest of the hemisphere. That when we talk about a creolized population, a population in which people have been born and raised in the United States. We also see a slavery that's largely Southern. If you look at this handout, you'll see that at the same time you get these dramatic increases in slaves, and at the same time you can see here very sort of quickly how many slaves are sent to the Caribbean and Brazil versus there are various estimates, but most of them now have settled in between 400 to 500,000 to the United States. So a relatively small chunk of the slave population grows into a relatively large chunk of Africans in the Western Hemisphere. We also, and you can see quickly this difference in mortality if you look at Virginia and Jamaica, where in Virginia 100,000 people had grown to a population of 300,000, while in Jamaica 800,000 had grown to a population of 350,000. We also see that slavery becomes a Southern phenomenon. Now this wasn't always true. In the beginning, almost every colony had some slaves and permitted slavery. But you see that states like Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, Pennsylvania, which have slavery around the time of the Revolution, the numbers quickly diminish. And the reason why the numbers quickly diminish are twofold. For one thing, that slavery was not that profitable in the North. The kinds of agriculture you do didn't make it profitable. For another, that Northern states start outlawing slavery. And new states that are brought in after the Revolution are brought in with constitutions that eliminate slavery from the beginning. So that by the time of the Civil War, New Jersey has a few slaves who have not been freed under a very gradual Emancipation Act. A couple of dozen older slaves. But most of the rest of the North, slavery which had existed, and New York City, which had at one point been a center of slavery and of slave transportation, have faded. At the other hand, what you also see is that slavery gets concentrated into particular belts. especially after 1800, when you get the development of the cotton gin, which made it profitable to grow cotton across large chunks of the South that you hadn't been able to. You get what become these cotton belts, and the darker it is, the higher the proportion of slaves in 1840. And you get what becomes called the Black Belt along the Mississippi River, the Natchez region, the Tobacco Belt, South Carolina, and then a large belt that curves up through Kentucky, Tennessee, Alabama, and Georgia. At the same time as slavery is spreading from these small belts along Virginia and South Carolina into the interior, we also see the problem of slavery and the effort to control and to discipline slaves becoming front and center. And so then in the Constitution, what's going to be about, what's going to happen to slavery, and how are Southern slave owners going to make sure that if their slaves run to these now free states in the North, that they're going to be returned, is a central problem of American politics. And in Southern states, you see this greater and greater development of slave codes meant to say what slaves can and can't do, and the development of these systems of whipping and discipline and punishment to prevent them and patrols to keep them from running. And so when we study the legal condition of slavery, or the patterns of whipping and punishment, we end up emphasizing the success of slavery, the way that slavery endured, the ways that slave owners were able to get what they wanted. On the other hand, what we also see when we look at slavery are the limits of that. That this is only one aspect of slavery. And that part of what we see as we look at how hard the owners had to work by the 1800s to keep slavery together, we see the kinds of efforts that slaves were making to carve out their own space within it, and the partial, limited but partial and meaningful success within that. That if, at the one hand, slavery was an effort, the efforts of slave owners were an effort to make people into property, then in that sense, by behaving as people, slaves worked against that and made that more difficult and raised this fundamental contradiction in American society. Of how could a system treat people like property once people became more and more aware that they were not merely property, but behaved and acted like people. Now, this resistance could take all kinds of forms, one of which was the form of family. And some of you taught, and I heard you talk about family formation as you saw in the weddings and so on. That over and over, as slaves described what it was that kept this effort to make slavery a political system, a demographic system, an agricultural system, a legal system that transformed them from people into property. When slaves explain why it is that they never believed that or surrendered to that or gave in to this notion of what they were, that family served at the heart of their explanation of how that worked. Harriet Jacobs, writing in New York right before the Civil War, wrote that, "As a child, my family lived together in a comfortable home. And though we were all slaves, I was so fondly shielded that I never dreamed I was a piece of merchandise." That these forms of family formation could be one way of protection. Another way of protection could be social associations, making up groups based upon political beliefs, on discussion. Henry Clay Bruce, who we'll talk a little bit more about, said slaves would listen carefully to what their owners say while talking to each other, and then as soon as the opportunity would permit, would go to the quarters, or to the woods, or to these meetings, and convey it. That in this act of conveying information, a building of a community that said, we're not merely property, but we have these connections, these human elements. Or through faith, which we'll also talk about. That these meetings, the importance of this religious dimension, to create not only the community of who's there, but also the explanation of why it was that in the eyes of a faith, that one was not property, but a person. And so together, these elements and others will give us access, partial access, to the way that slaves made meaning of their lives, the process of making meaning, and the ways that meaning created openings within slavery.